Good evening and happy Thanksgiving. I'm William Brangham. Judy Woodruff is away. On the NewsHour tonight, hunger in America. Inflation is outpacing wage growth, casting a shadow over many Americans' Thanksgiving as food banks struggle to meet the need. Then, the expanding electorate. Young voters made their presence known in the midterms, potentially changing political calculations for the future. And the cultural cost. Ukraine grapples with the loss of priceless artwork stolen by Russian forces during their occupation of Kherson.
There wasn't even room for an apple to fall. There were 14,000 items in total. How many are left now? I just don't know.
All of that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. This day of Thanksgiving here at home has been a day of deprivation in Ukraine, where millions are going without warmth or water. Kyiv's mayor says 70% of the city was without power today after Russian missiles battered its power grid on Wednesday. This morning, residents in the Ukrainian capital joined long lines to pick up their day's worth of water. But many remained adamant that they will never give in.
The worst feeling we had was during the first days of the war, when there was a danger that our so-called friends, the Russians, would get here. But as for now, we only have some disruptions. We'll get over it.
In Moscow, the Kremlin laid blame on Ukraine's government for its people's plight, saying the war will end only if Kyiv meets Russia's demands. Russian lawmakers today approved new restrictions on anything seen as promoting LGBTQ rights. The additions to existing law will outlaw advertising, books, films, and theater productions said to contain what the government calls propaganda. The Kremlin began moving to quash LGBTQ rights in 2013 and then outlawed same-sex marriage in 2020. The UN's Human Rights Council has voted to condemn Iran's violent repression of protests and set up an independent investigation. Activists say more than 400 people have been killed and thousands arrested. The unrest began in September after a young woman, Mahsa Amini, died in police custody. In Geneva today, the UN's Human Rights Commissioner called for Iran's leaders to stop the suffering.
Unnecessary and disproportionate use of force must come to an end. The old methods and the fortress mentality of those who wield power simply don't work. In fact, they only aggravate the situation.
Iran's representative to the UN Council denounced today's vote as politically motivated. China is reporting its highest daily COVID-19 count since the virus first swamped Wuhan nearly 3 years ago. In response, lockdowns and mass testing expanded again, despite growing unrest. In Beijing, authorities built a new round of metal barricades around residential areas. People are only allowed out to buy food or seek medical treatment. Thousands of teachers walked off the job today in Scotland, demanding better pay and working conditions in the face of soaring inflation. The strike was the first of its kind in four decades. Elsewhere, British workers picketed outside post offices and universities in the biggest coordinated walkouts this year. Back in this country, the mass shootings in recent days made this Thanksgiving a day of mourning in some cities, and they prompted a new call for action. It came from President Biden as he visited firefighters and first responders in Nantucket, Massachusetts, where he's spending the holiday. He again urged Congress to act.
The idea we still allow semi-automatic weapons to be purchased is sick. It's just sick. It has no social redeeming value. Zero. None. Not a single solitary rationale for it except profit for the gun manufacturer.
Can you do anything about gun laws during the lame duck, sir?
I'm going to try.
Congress did approve expanding background checks and red flag laws earlier this year, but there's no indication that any new legislation could pass in the final weeks of the current Congress. Election results in Alaska are finally in, with Democrats keeping the state's only U.S. House seat and Republicans holding a Senate seat. Democratic Representative Mary Peltola has won a full term after winning a special election last March, and Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski has been reelected. She was the sole Senate Republican voting to convict former President Trump at his impeachment trial last year. And Ford is recalling more than 634,000 SUVs worldwide because of a risk that cracked fuel injectors can ignite fires. The recall affects the Bronco Sport and Escape models from 2020 through 2023. For now, though, the automaker is not recommending that owners stop driving the vehicles. Still to come on the NewsHour, AOL co-founder Steve Case discusses the surprising entrepreneurs who are reimagining America's economic landscape. An award-winning baker fuses multiple cultural influences into his recipes. We examine the storylines to watch in the ongoing World Cup, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
This holiday, as so many of us are sitting down with friends and family at tables overstuffed with food, there are millions of Americans who aren't nearly so fortunate. So Thanksgiving Day is also a reminder of the stark reality of what's called food insecurity. It is widespread in the United States, and there's no obvious end in sight. Organizations that address this need say they've had to ramp up their efforts this year. One of those groups is called Feeding America, and in 2019, they distributed 4.2 billion meals. In 2021, that number increased by 1 billion to 5.2 billion meals. In 2019, some 40 million people received some kind of charity food assistance, but last year, that number jumped to 53 million. Earlier this week, I spoke with the chief operating officer of Feeding America, Katie Fitzgerald. We talked about what's driving this and what more needs to be done. Katie Fitzgerald, great to have you on the NewsHour. So, tens of millions of Americans are technically food insecure. But what is your sense? Do those federal numbers give a full and accurate picture of the issue here in the U.S.?
Yeah, thank you, William, for having me today. It gives us a perspective on the issue, but it doesn't really give us a full understanding of what food insecurity looks like in the U.S. For instance, last year, we estimate that 53 million people accessed the charitable food system to help make sure they had food on the table for themselves, for their children, seniors, people with disabilities. So that is obviously 20 million more or so than the food insecurity rate, which is really measuring whether people on a given day when they're asked that question can afford to buy food. A lot of folks are making sure they have enough food by accessing that charitable food system.
And it's really just incredibly shocking numbers in this country. Can you help me with an issue about terminology? When we say food insecurity versus hunger, can you delineate the distinctions there?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Hunger is something, William, that we all can relate to in the sense that we know that feeling when our stomach is growling, we're uncomfortable, maybe we're having trouble focusing, and we need to eat. And it's our physiology that tells us that we're hungry, and we all have that feeling. Food insecurity is really a socioeconomic condition that people find themselves in when they have to make economic trade-offs and have to cut their food budgets and limit the amount of food that they're able to procure for themselves or their families because they simply don't have enough money to make ends meet, to pay their rent, their mortgage, their utilities, all those kinds of things that are really necessary. So there's a relationship, obviously, between the two. We might not be able to eradicate food insecurity fully in this country, but we sure can end hunger through a mix of private supports and public benefits.
So when you look at those tens of millions of Americans who are food insecure, what are the principal drivers of that?
Well, a complex question, to be sure. So a lot of what's driving food insecurity is essentially a mix of economic pressures on American households. So the pressures of wages not really experiencing real growth for a very long time in this country up until recently before the pandemic, healthcare expenses, which have exploded over the last couple of decades, education, higher education. So the mix of the economic pressures on American households from a wage and expense perspective are what's really keeping food insecurity rates higher than they should be in a country where food is plentiful and we are one of the richest countries on the earth.
Right. That is the great irony here, that when people hear about this idea of hunger or food insecurity in a country of such plenty, it's striking to so many of us, not just on Thanksgiving week. When we think back to during the pandemic, when so many people were at home or out of work, there were enormous federal supports, food assistance, additional salary compensation, school meals. A lot of that aid has dried up or gone away now. That's also got to be a major contributing factor to all this, too.
Yeah, we are in another perfect storm. We experienced the pandemic and the surge in food insecurity as a perfect storm. And I would say we're sort of in a new iteration of that right now. And you're exactly right. The many public supports that were put into place in response to the sudden shuttering of our economy and people losing their livelihoods overnight are going away, if not have gone away. And inflation and food prices is now presenting a new major problem for people's ability to feed themselves and their families, as I'm sure the audience knows. So that combination of federal commodity food being down, public benefits being down, food prices really pushing many more millions of Americans into food insecurity. And the food banks are experiencing those same price increases. And so they are getting less for their dollar, and they're less able to purchase their way to fill that gap.
I know organizations like yours and a lot of local food banks saw a good uptick in donations, financial and actual tangible donations during the pandemic. Where does that stand now? How is giving going in this country?
Well, people are still extremely generous and committed to the cause of ending hunger in the United States. So we're grateful for those gifts. But donations are down compared to this time last year. And again, part of the challenge is food banks are having to spend more and they're getting less food for their dollar. So what we're seeing is 70% of the Feeding America food banks have told us that they will spend more to purchase food this year than last year, and they'll get less for that money. In addition, over 40% of our food banks are operating in a deficit budget in order to do that. So they are dipping into the reserves, into those funds that they raised last year to pay for food that they need today. So we are really hoping and encouraging people who can provide some support to the Feeding America network that they will do that.
All right. That is Katie Fitzgerald, the Chief Operating Officer of Feeding America. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, William, for having me and for bringing greater visibility to this important issue.
This midterm cycle, young voters turned out in historic numbers and helped deliver Democrats some key victories in toss-up states. John Yang has more.
Analysts say Gen Z and millennial voters played a key role in the midterm elections to help Democrats stave off the Republican red wave. While they were a relatively small portion of the electorate, voters under 30 have shown increased participation in the last few elections and supported Democratic candidates by bigger margins than ever before. Two voices to talk about this voting bloc. John Della Volpe is director of polling at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics. He's the author of Fight, How Gen Z is Channeling Their Fear and Passion to Save America. And Victor Shi, he's a student at UCLA and director of strategy for Voters of Tomorrow, a nonpartisan Gen Z-centered civics advocacy group. Gentlemen, thanks to you both for joining us. John Della Volpe, I'd like to start with you. How big a difference did these voters make in the midterms?
Thanks for having us. I think they made all the difference, John. Let me break it down for you pretty simply. When you think about Gen Z and you add in millennials, okay, those are essentially two generations of voters who have a similar set of values. They voted for Democrats by 18 points, okay? Plus 18 for Democrats. The under 40 vote, 59 to 41. Republicans won the over 40 vote, which, as you said, is much larger, by 10 points. So if not for Gen Z and the combination of Gen Z and millennials, I do think we have that red wave that so many people were expecting. Gen Z, specifically, the people under 30, increased their level of participation relative to the average, increased their support for Democrats, and made all the difference in the world a couple weeks ago.
And are there particular races where this was key, John?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of different examples, and one of which is Pennsylvania, a very, very close race. The under 30 cohort supported John Fetterman at 70%. 70% for Fetterman among the 18 to 29 group. When you go look out west to Arizona as another example, Mark Kelly won this cohort by 50 points. I think the reason that the Democrat Senator Cortez Masto won in Nevada was similar enthusiasm among young people. She won a double-digit victory. I think her final number, according to the exit polls, was in the mid-60s. And I think we saw higher turnout than we normally did, even relative to 2018 in Nevada. So those are three very, very quick examples of some of the title races that tipped because of younger people. But real quick, John, this isn't the first cycle that we've seen this. This happened in 2018, and it also happened in 2020, so this should not be a surprise.
Victor Shi, what's motivating you and voters like you, voters your age, and why are so many breaking for Democrats?
So the biggest thing that we're seeing in terms of just having conversations with young people and some of the polling that we've seen among young people leading up to the election is the Dobbs decision and overturning Roe versus Wade. Because at the end of the day, that was the first time that young people who thought that abortion would be a guaranteed right in their life was overturned by the Supreme Court. And then all along the way, you also saw Republicans engaging in really a sustained effort to attack our lives, starting with abortion, then going into classrooms, controlling what we can say about, you know, racial conversations, doing LGBTQ stuff. So all of these things, I think, contribute to this overwhelming sense among young people that Republicans don't really care about our lives. And so that's one hand. And on the other hand, you also have Democrats delivering for a lot of the things that young people care about, things like climate change, things like education reform, things like making sure that we have racial justice with the pardoning of people who have simple marijuana possession. So I think it was this really clear contrast between both parties, one that cared about us and one that didn't. And I think that's why you saw a lot of young people turn out overwhelmingly for Democrats in this election cycle.
John Dellavolpe, I want to go back to the point you just made, that this is the third straight election where you've seen this. For so long before, young voters were seen, and also in the turnout, were unreliable as compared to the older voters. Why the change? Why the shift?
I think that's a fair assessment. So when baby boomers were young voters, when Gen X were young voters, and when millennials were young voters, they voted at roughly half the level as this generation of Gen Z. And two things happened, I think, John, in 2018. The combination of President Trump's election on the heels of President Obama showed how relevant politics can be in the lives of young people. That's one. People began to pay attention and to see the tangible difference, part one. The second part, though, is on the heels of the tragedy of Parkland, and the work that those young people did to call attention to the epidemic of school shootings, to mobilize folks, to register, and to make sure that they voted. The combination of those two factors, I believe, basically kind of awakened the civic spirit within Gen Z. The first time they could vote was 2018. We saw a similar effect in 2020, and now, again, it's carrying over. So politics is very, very meaningful for this generation.
And John Dellavolpe, are they going to continue to be important in the 2024 elections and beyond?
Well, John, like we said, we now have two generations who essentially have the same values, okay? Millennials and Gen Z. Gen Z, slightly more progressive than millennials, but together, they overwhelmingly support Democrats. Together, John, they will be 40% of the electorate in 2024. So as Victor said, the time of like ignoring or actually, you know, not taking seriously or even mocking young people, that needs to be over if you're seeking to win a national election.
And Victor Xi, are we seeing, are you seeing your peers doing more than just voting? Are they organizing? We now have a Gen Z member of Congress next January. Are more running for office and being more active than just voting?
Absolutely. So you basically, with Gen Zers and young people in general, what you saw with us that made us such a unique generation before this election, before 2020, was that we weren't afraid to go to the streets and protest and make our voices heard. You saw that with protests like the climate change movement. You saw that with the Black Lives Matter movement. You saw that with the Women's March. Just so many young people going out to the streets and making their voices heard. At the same time, you saw a lot of young people go register to vote and actually vote starting in 2018, like John said. But what made this election so special compared to previous elections was that you saw a historic number of Gen Zers actually run for office. And that was just pretty remarkable. Not only that, though, you saw a historic number of Gen Zers actually win office. So I'm thinking of people like you said, Maxwell Frost, who's going to be the first Gen Zer from a state like Florida, going to Congress and representing Gen Z there. But you also have Gen Zers running across the country down ballot. Someone like Nabila Syed from my home state, Illinois, is going to be the first member of the Illinois state legislature who is Gen Z. And so all across the country, what you're seeing from Gen Zers isn't just the reality that they were, you know, going out to the streets and protesting, but we're also going out there and voting and running for office and actually winning office. And that's going to translate into some real tangible differences for Gen Zers and what we care about.
And talk about the difference that this is going to make, or that you want, you hope it will make, as your generation and millennials remain important politically. What do you want to see happen? What do you want to see come from that?
So representation really matters, and having someone who is of kind of similar life experiences, who understands the concerns of Generation Z, is going to be really important when we think about what policies we want to get passed, things like gun reform, things like, you know, more bold action on climate change. All of those things are going to really matter with more Gen Zers in Congress. And I think what we're going to see a lot of kind of what's going to happen with the policies that get passed from the federal level and state level. At the same time, I think it's just important for young people too to look at their, you know, institutions and government and see someone who actually looks like us, someone who is young, someone who is vibrant, who might be diverse. And so I think, you know, it's going to be great in terms of just kind of looking at politics and being inspired and actually being civically empowered, but also into tangible policy differences, too.
Victor Xi of Voters of Tomorrow and a student at UCLA. John Della Volpe at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics. Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
As the invasion of Ukraine grinds on, preserving that country's artistic heritage has taken on new urgency. Earlier this month, in a major blow to Moscow, Russian soldiers withdrew from the southern city of Kherson. But before retreating, those troops looted homes and businesses throughout the city, and they emptied one of Ukraine's most precious art museums. Lindsay Hilsum of Independent Television News has that report.
Ukraine's national anthem echoes across the streets of Kherson. Russian posters have been torn down. This is a culture war, a brutal battle for the soul and identity of a people.
Slava Україні!
Україна!
Прошу. Тут стояли величезні роботи.
No one knows that better than the director of the Kherson Art Museum, famed for having one of Ukraine's best collections of European paintings, which she had put in storage.
Here, Britain, France, Italy, Poland, Latvia were all represented. It was a huge collection. There were paintings from the 17th to the 20th century.
Over 5 days, just before they withdrew, Russian soldiers turned up in trucks and stole the most valuable paintings, icons, and sculptures.
There wasn't even room for an apple to fall. There were 14,000 items in total. How many are left now? I just don't know.
They did everything they could to protect this collection. They put it in storage and they locked the doors. But look, everything's gone. It's not the monetary value. It's the cultural value. That's incalculable for the people of Kherson and Ukraine.
According to the director, five of the 20 museum staff collaborated with the Russians, telling them exactly what was where. She's been sent photos of the paintings which the soldiers took to a museum in Simferopol, the capital of Russian-occupied Crimea. She can recognize the markings and labels. Ukraine's Minister of Culture came from Kyiv to tour the Kherson Art Museum and see what's been lost.
Are you shocked?
Shocked. Shocked, it's not the word. I'm furious because this particularly show what does Russia mean when they're fighting against our identity. So if there are our heritage, there is our identity. If they stole heritage, they believe that we wouldn't continue to live and to create, but we will.
One woman filmed from her apartment Russian soldiers coming in the dead of night to the main pedestrian street. The next day, everyone could see the empty plinth from which they'd removed the statue of the 18th century general Alexander Suvorov, one of three statues honoring Russian imperial heroes that the Russians stole. St. Catherine's Cathedral contained a relic with even more resonance for President Putin. For him, religion and history have become inseparable. He often says that he regards Ukraine as part of Russia, as it was at the height of the Russian Empire. The bones of Prince Potemkin, Catherine the Great's lover, who founded Kherson in 1778, have lain here since his death. The priest took me into the vault from where Russian soldiers stole the bones in late October, not for money, but because this is a war of imperial reconquest.
На этом постаменте лежал гроб с останками князя Потемкина.
On this pedestal lay the coffin with the bones of Prince Potemkin. The Russians came one evening and carried it away. Now this place is empty, this place where his remains rested for more than 200 years.
The Russian ideology that made them steal Potemkin's bones, is that the same ideology which made them invade Ukraine?
Yes, no doubt. Their main aim is to restore the empire, and for that they use force, violence. They committed violence against those who live here in the name of those ideas of theirs and because of this imaginary connection with the past.
Armies have looted and claimed God is on their side since time immemorial. Today, the Russian state has embarked on the kind of plunder Potemkin himself would have recognized, as if stealing the emblems of the past could recreate it now in the 21st century.
Steve Case is best known as co-founder and former CEO of AOL, or America Online, the trailblazing internet company that helped bring the fledgling World Wide Web to millions of Americans. But today, he's putting his entrepreneurial skills to use in a different way, to help regular Americans launch their own businesses. He spoke about his efforts when he recently sat down with Judy Woodruff to discuss his new book, The Rise of the Rest.
Steve Case, welcome back to the NewsHour. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Judy. Always great to be with you.
So it was way back in 1985 when you started AOL. It was all about, you said at the time, getting all of America online. And it turns out that has a bearing on what you're trying to do when you talk about the rise of the rest. Explain that.
Yeah, there are some parallels. In those early days, it was trying to level the playing field so everybody has access to information and education and so forth. Now, with Rise of the Rest, it's how do you make sure everybody has an opportunity. If they want to start a company, they can start it anywhere in the country, not just on the coast. Most of the venture capital that backs new companies goes to places like California, New York, and Massachusetts. They get 75% of the venture capital. We want to get more of that venture capital to entrepreneurs all over the country, and that really what led us to the Rise of the Rest.
You've been working on this for years, and you've been traveling around the country. spending time in these places. What was it that drove this for you?
It started a little over a decade ago. I was asked to chair something called the National Advisory Council on Innovation and Entrepreneurship, which then led to a White House initiative called Startup America Partnership that President Obama asked me to chair. So that really got me on this trajectory, and I realized the role new companies play in job creation, but also realize this issue of it's harder for entrepreneurs in many parts of the country to start those companies because they don't have access to capital. So then we started hitting the road with our Rise of the Rest buses, and we've gone all over the country. And part of the reason I decided to write this book is there's amazing stories about entrepreneurs building extraordinary companies in surprising places that people don't think of as the place where new startups are launching. When people think of startups, they sometimes focus too much on tech and too much on Silicon Valley. Startups are any new company, and they're happening all around the country, but most people don't know about some of those stories, which has led to the book.
What defines a successful startup? I mean, what is it that makes the difference between one that has a good shot at making it and getting the money, frankly, that they need invested to do it, and ones that don't?
So it starts with what is the idea, but then you have to build a team around the idea. It's not, entrepreneurship is a team sport. It's not just about the founder, it's about the team they build. You have to establish the partnerships that you need to really scale. But a lot of it does come back to that initial capital, which is why we're focused on trying to level the playing field and get more capital to more of those entrepreneurs, no matter where they are in the country.
And why has that been so hard? Is it just habit that, as you said, people think of Silicon Valley or they think of New York or some of the big city, but they don't think of some of the places?
It's a mix. Venture capital just started about 50 years ago. It's a relatively new idea, and actually started in New York and then Boston and then San Francisco, and it got built up around those places. As a result, since that's where most of the capital is, a lot of entrepreneurs in the last couple of decades in different parts of the country felt like they had to leave where they were to go to the coast because that's kind of where the action was. That was where the money is. There's been a brain drain of people leaving. And what we said even when we started nearly a decade ago is how do we slow the brain drain of people leaving and create a boomerang of people returning so you can start and scale more companies and create more jobs in these communities? As you know, part of the divide we have in this country is an opportunity gap where some people in some places are doing really well and a lot of people in a lot of places are feeling left out and left behind. This is one way to solve that by starting new companies that can create new jobs in those communities.
To what extent do you think this disparity across the country has contributed to some of our political divide?
It's tragic that so many people growing up in the middle of the country or going to school in the middle of the country feel like they have to leave a place they love because there's not enough opportunity there and they go someplace else. One of the great stories in the book is an entrepreneur, Jonathan Webb, who started a company called App Harvest in eastern Kentucky, coal country, Appalachia, which has had a tough run for the last several decades. But he decided to start a company there that's created 600 jobs in the last couple of years in a place that has really felt left behind. And so this is part of the answer. We've got to launch new companies. We've got to create new jobs. Half of the Fortune 500, the biggest companies, turn over every 25 years. Half. So you can't just rely on your big companies. You have to be launching new companies, some of which will fail, because that's the nature of startups, but some of which can be the Fortune 500 companies of tomorrow. And that's the only way, I think, to renew these communities. And it's at least a partial way to help knit together a very divided nation.
You also write, Steve Case, about the importance of diversity, of making sure women, people of color, and others who traditionally haven't been thought of as job creators, that they are part of this. And the same thing, you've had some strong views about immigration, too.
Yeah, I have a chapter in the book on the diversity imperative. And the data there, I talked about 75% of venture capital going to three states. If you look at people, women are 50% of the population. Female founders get less than 10% of venture capital. Latinos are 18% of the population. Latino founders get less than 2% of venture capital. And Black Americans are 13% of the population, but Black founders get less than 1% of venture capital. So it does matter where you live, and it does matter kind of what you look like, but if you have an idea, you have the opportunity to turn it into a company and create jobs and drive growth in your community. So that's why it's so important to level the playing field. And on the immigration front, it's also important that we continue to be a welcoming nation, that we, you know, get people from all over the world who want to be part of this next American story. 40% of the top companies, the Fortune 500 companies, were started by immigrants or children of immigrants. So it's been part of the secret sauce that's made America so strong. And we We need to remember that and continue to be a magnet for talent. It has gotten a little harder to come to this country. It has gotten harder to stay in this country. As a result, some of the companies that could have started here and created jobs here are now starting other places.
This is a book about the private sector, largely. It's about people creating businesses and hiring and so on. But you also write about there is a role for government in all this.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a role at the national level in terms of passing legislation around immigration reform or incentives to around investment. The Jobs Act passed about 10 years ago that helped a lot of startups just this summer. Some of the legislation that passed, including the CHIPS and Science Act, which passed with bipartisan support, funds some initiatives around semiconductors, but also allocated $10 billion to support regional hubs, exactly what we're talking about with the Rise Arrest. So there's a role at the national level, and there's also a big role at the state and local level. The governors and the mayors that are really focusing on new companies, trying to create a fertile environment to start new companies, are the ones that are really positioned to grow in the coming years.
So Steve Case, AOL, Rise of the Rest, what's next?
Well, I've got a lot of work to do on Rise the Rest. As I said, 75% of capital is going to three states. When you talk about people, that there's a real problem there. So we're going to be working on this for quite some time. I think we really need to level the playing field. I think we can. And even the pandemic has created a little bit of a tipping point, a little bit of an accelerant. Some people have decided to move to other places. Remote work is offering opportunities for people to live and work differently, which is helping these Rise the Rest cities. So I'm optimistic about this next chapter, and I'll keep at it.
Steve Case, the book is The Rise of the Rest, How Entrepreneurs in Surprising Places are Building the New American Dream. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
For those baking at home these holidays, you might want to take some tips from our next guest, award-winning baker and author Brian Ford. He catapulted to fame during the pandemic's bread baking frenzy, inspiring millions with his innovative twists on sourdough bread, while also celebrating the cultures of Latin America. Earlier this year, he invited our Jeff Bennett into his home in Queens, New York, for an inside look at the treasure trove that can be found in his kitchen, complete, of course, with vats of pungent sourdough starter.
Brian Ford catapulted to prominence during the pandemic's bread baking frenzy, inspiring millions with his blog and Instagram account full of innovative twists on sourdough bread baking, all while celebrating the baking cultures of Latin America. Brian invited us into his home in Queens, New York. His kitchen is a baker's treasure trove, complete, of course, with vats of pungent sourdough starter.
The most important part is just getting a nice whiff of it. So you gotta, don't be scared.
Whoa, wow.
Woo! That boy got shook.
I got a little too close.
You got shook.
Man.
His first cookbook, released in the summer of 2020, New World Sourdough, sold out its first printing. That led to starring in his own cooking show, Baked in Tradition, on Chip and Joanna Gaines' Magnolia Network.
All of a sudden, people was just started baking and like, you already know. I don't even have to tell you, man. I mean, y'all kept up with the news. It just became a whole thing. Yeah. Everyone was baking bread.
Brian says he's been cooking and baking for as long as he can remember, ultimately finding his calling after leaving behind his career as an accountant.
What about baking sort of drew you in?
Man, baking is romantic. Baking is like, it's like a meditation. Hmm. It's simple. It's, you don't have to be so precise. I mean, the dough is a living creature too. I mean, every single time you bake, it's different. Even if you use the same recipe to the T, every single time it's going to be different. I mean, the temperature variables and your emotions, your mood, how you feel, gets translated into the dough. If you're having a bad day and you bake, you're going to make some bread that's probably not great. Mm-hmm. When you're having a great day, your bread's going to be great.
The child of Honduran immigrants, Brian imparts lessons learned from cooking in his mother's kitchen.
My parents worked so hard when they came to this country, and my mom put herself through school. She put herself through three different colleges to ultimately get her accounting degree when she was like 46.
Wow.
During those days, when she was working hard, especially in the summertime, I would be home taking care of my little sister, and I would cook for my mom, because she would wake up, she'd go to an internship, and then go to school at night. She'd come home exhausted.
Yeah.
Well, and so I learned quickly from what she taught me how to cook.
I read somewhere where you said that, you go into any bakery, across the country, and you're going to see croissants and baguettes.
Yeah, man. I love it. I love that.
Yeah, why can't the same be true for Honduran food?
I agree 100%. And the reason I have that sentiment is not because I don't like the taste of croissants and baguettes. I think they taste great. Like most bakers, when I started, I was obsessed with making those things. When I was an accountant, I was like every day perfecting croissants at home. I was like, I've got to learn how to make croissants. That's like the gold standard.
Yeah.
But the fact remains that this kind of Western European ideology seems to permeate people's thoughts when they want to open a bakery. I'm trying to be more in touch with, the indigenous people of the new world, Latin America. I mean, we are very, very beautiful people. We have beautiful baking traditions as well. I grew up eating semitas, rosquillas, like delicious dunked in coffee. But everyone wants to just make some brioche. So we won't play with no brioche.
But alfajores are a different story.
We're going to make some alfajores.
Okay.
All right, which is essentially one of the most popular cookies you'll find in Latin America.
The recipe is simple. Cream together butter and sugar. Add egg yolks.
You can see here, it's creamy, smooth. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the base.
Incorporate the dry ingredients.
I got a little bit of salt, some baking powder. I've got white flour. I've got whole grain flour. And most importantly, I have cornstarch.
Lastly, add some vanilla extract and lemon zest. Roll the dough, chill it, and bake the cookies until they're barely brown.
We're going to check the bottom very carefully. That's a beautiful color.
Spread on some dulce de leche, sandwich them together, and roll them in shredded coconut.
And now we have
an
alfajor gigante.
Yeah, definitely gigante.
Oh, wow.
This is great.
Yeah.
I'm wearing it, though.
You make it for the kids, you know what I'm saying? Make it quick. It's something fun you can do.
Yeah.
Teach a little bit about some history, some Latin American history, and eat something delicious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Through his baking, Brian encourages exploration.
I think people just focus on the wrong aspects of baking, aesthetic stuff. Instead of focusing on flavor, focusing on the fact that you made something with your own two hands that you should be proud of, like focusing on sharing what you made with your friends and family, those things should be first and foremost. Then you can start like, oh, well, it doesn't have the big air pockets and all that kind of thing. People get obsessive about crumb structure, which is just crazy. This is bread.
Yeah.
You imagine ancient civilizations when they started making bread, you imagine them sitting down and being like, damn, the inside don't look good. Oh, man.
Throw it out and start over.
Shoot. Yeah. What did I do wrong?
It takes some trial and error as Brian Ford redefines what artisan baking can and should be.
I'm just saying I tried to focus specifically on Latin American baking, tapping into my culture and my experiences and trying to make the best possible breads and pastries around. And just a lot of patience, a lot of time down here in the kitchen, and a lot of messes to clean up.
The Men's World Cup in Qatar is already in full swing and has been packed full of drama. If you saw Brazil's first goal today against Serbia, you know what I'm talking about. For a broader look at the world of soccer and what to be watching for in these games, last month, Amna Nawaz spoke with a soccer writer and broadcaster before the games began. Here's another look.
There is lots of anticipation and excitement around the games, but the venue has sparked criticism, including over Qatar's outlawing of LGBTQ rights and the deaths of migrant workers the nation depends on to prepare for the Cup. Roger Bennett has been watching all of this. He's the host of the soccer podcast Men in Blazers and the co-author of the new book, Gods of Soccer, the pantheon of the 100 greatest soccer players, which takes a look at the careers of top players in sports history. And he joins me now. Roger Bennett, welcome back to the NewsHour. Always good to see you. There is no way you're going to get people to agree on the top 100 players. Let's just put that out there. Even you admit in the book, it's an act of folly. So how do you do it? What are the core criteria in this book?
With a certain degree of chutzpah, I would say, but you need to acknowledge up front to try and create a definitive list of the 100 greatest to ever play the game. It is an act of folly, only undertaken by those who love to grab the third rail in life. But we got our staff together, and the joy of it is everybody sees the game differently. It's completely subjective. There's a manager, Jurgen Klopp, who says that football is the world's most important, least important thing. And that's what I think makes watching sport so compelling. So our goal with this book was to drop our 100. It's a ridiculously subjective thing to do, but we're prepared to defend them with the heat of 1,000 suns.
All right, the book goes back in time. It travels around the world. I noticed a number of players from perhaps one of the greatest teams of all time, the U.S. Women's National Team, rightly so, are featured in the book. It's not just about achievements on the field and career stats, though. You talk a lot about the impact more broadly on the game and society around them, like in the case of Breonna Scurry, right?
Yeah, to us, when two teams take the field, their nation's history, their nation's culture, their nation's politics take the field alongside them. That's what makes the World Cup such a scintillating experience for the world to witness. And so greatness can be defined in many ways. There's a lot of glory in our book, the Pelés, the Maradonas, the Mia Hamms, the Alex Morgans. But for me, football is ultimately a mirror to humanity. And the book is also about empathy, loyalty, connection to the collective, about dreams, and most importantly, tenacity. And Breonna Scurry is one of the most remarkable footballers I've ever met, hailing from Minnesota, the only African-American on any team she ever played for, from the youngest youth levels all the way through to the World Cup-winning U.S. Women's National Team. And when you speak to the young African-American players who now flourish on that world champion team, they all point to her as the pathfinder. It was a very lonely journey for Breonna, but now she can look at everything that she's seeded with just a sense of wonder.
You have all those marquee players, as you noted. Also, my personal favorite, I should mention, Zinedine Zidane. Zizou is in the book. Thank you for that. A lot of other players many people may not have ever heard of, though. I'm curious, Raj, do you have a favorite player, a favorite story in the book?
There's so many. Nadia Nadim is one that comes to mind. Her father was a general in the Afghan army. He was hunted down and killed by the Taliban. The family fled to Denmark, a refugee camp. She found football, realized she could excel at this thing, rose to become an elite football player, all while on the side mastering 7 languages and also becoming a reconstructive doctor of medical surgery. She really is the kind of human being that you look at and it makes a mockery of the old adage, you should just stick to sports.
So a couple of the players featured in the book we will be seeing at the World Cup, as we mentioned, hosted by Qatar this year. Raj, this is a tournament usually hosted in the summer months. It's now being played in November and December. Tell us why.
It's for reasons that honestly break my heart. The World Cup is the spine to my life. For millions of people around the world, 5 billion human beings are expected to tune in. It's been compared to an eclipse that hits the whole world for an entire month simultaneously. And the organising body, FIFA, who are meant to honour the good in football and safeguard it, saw fit to award the World Cup to Qatar, a tiny Gulf state smaller than Connecticut. In a podcast that we've just made, World Corrupt, we interviewed a spokesperson for the Department of Justice who was there when the award went down. They gave the 2018 World Cup to Putin's Russia and then the 2022 World Cup to Qatar, who wanted it almost to change the way they're seen from a state that's petro-fueled with human rights concerns, with LGBTQ concerns. And what's ensued since that award in 2010 is that 6,500 human beings, workers working on the roads, the hotels, the infrastructure, the stadia, are reported to have died. It really is a World Cup that's soaked in blood. And for fans like me who live for the World Cup every 4 years, that it's the greatest creator of collective memories, we all have to now shape up and find our own moral position.
So it is prediction time. A ton of questions to ask you. How will the U.S. team do this year? What are their chances?
Despite my accent, I ride with Team America. Becoming an American citizen is the greatest joy of my life. And I say that because our young American team, a very raw, incredibly dynamic, but totally inexperienced collective, will face in the opening round, November 25th, England, one of the powerhouses of Europe. I ride of America. It's a raw cast of characters. I keep my fingers crossed. the World Cup's coming back to the United States in 2026. And I believe whatever happens on the field for the American team, they will be all the better off for it when they play before a home crowd, then in a tournament, which is really going to put the sport over the top.
That is Roger Bennett, host of the Men in Blazers podcast, joining us tonight. Raj, always good to see you. Thank you.
Courage.
Keith Whatley is the founding executive director of Uncommon Law, a group that helps people who are serving life sentences navigate the parole process. Here, he shares his brief but spectacular take on changing the narrative about people who commit violent crimes.
I've studied thousands of people who've committed violent crimes. The people who commit violent crimes are not evil. They're usually just scared. I immerse myself in the traumatic experiences that people have. I do that in order to help them understand why they commit violent crimes so that they can create a pathway out of prison. And that looks like months or years of one-on-one counseling, guiding people to do the introspection that they need to do to understand why they made some of the decisions they did. Once they trust us to share with us their most painful, shameful secrets, that's when we can do the work. Nationwide, there are a couple hundred thousand people serving life sentences. Most of the ones we're talking about are serving life with the possibility of parole. And if the parole board finds that they can safely be released, they grant them parole. Most of the time, they deny parole. When I first started in this work, it really didn't seem to matter what people did in prison to change their lives. The parole board focused on the crime to decide whether this person should ever be released. What has happened over time is the work we do now matters in their consideration of someone's readiness for parole. And because people are doing the work, they're ready. We have a better than 60% rate of our clients being granted parole at their hearings, compared to the state averages around 20 to 25%. The people we've worked with, they have so dramatically changed who they are and who they associate with and how they relate to the rest of the world that they are extremely unlikely to ever commit a new violent crime. We've had more than 200 of our clients now released from their life sentences. Not one of them has ever gone on to be convicted of a new violent crime. Just this morning, actually, had a client who was released from prison after 33 years. And he was first locked up when he was 16 for a murder that he committed because he was trying to act tough. He had just got beaten up and he wanted to prove that he was tough. Once he was willing to be vulnerable, to share himself with us and with the parole board, be honest about his crime, his history, his journey through prison, he was able to go home. People are not the same as they were when they were teenagers. And it's not just their age that's changed, but they've changed who they are, how they relate to the world. They've gained an understanding into who they can be. A lot of the people we work with go on to start their own programs, their own nonprofits, mentoring programs with people in juvenile halls and schools. And these are the people who can lead the charge to transform violence in these communities, and we need to give them an opportunity to do that. My name is Keith Whatley, and this has been my brief but spectacular take on transforming the narrative about people who commit violent crimes.
You can watch more brief but spectacular videos online at pbs.org/newshour/brief. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm William Brangham. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you so much for spending a bit of your Thanksgiving with us. We'll see you soon.